ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just one day after Jack McLennan's relationship fell apart, he vanished.
I couldn't believe this was happening.
Immediately, accusations started flying.
You need to cough up and you need to confess.
But it soon became clear there was so much more to the story.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's peace, of sorts, 8 months since the ceasefire began in Gaza. Could you describe the situation, do you think, as peaceful, Latika?
Kylie, words like ceasefire and peace have asterisks next to them, don't they? And Gaza is no different.
Today we're speaking to a human rights lawyer who grew up in Gaza, who wants to make sure his hometown doesn't go missing from the headlines as war expands to Iran and Lebanon.
And why he thinks Australia hasn't been transparent about its exports to Israel. I'm Latika Burke.
I'm Kylie Morris. This is Global Roaming. So, Latika, at the moment, what's happening in Iran, I guess, is really dominating the headlines and certainly the tensions between Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. Differences, it would seem, about whether or not Lebanon should continue to be attacked in the way it has been by Israel. Donald Trump apparently reading the riot act to Benjamin Netanyahu, trying to rein in those attacks in the interests of the pursuit of some kind of ceasefire with Iran. Very difficult to know, though there's a lot of negotiation happening out in the open, but also presumably behind closed doors. I know you've been speaking to an Israeli commentator, Latika. What did you learn from that?
Yes, Kylie. I mean, today's episode really is a nice, neat bookend to yesterday's. Geraldine and I spoke to Nadav Eyal about the domestic politics in Israel and how that's driving this conflict and shaping what might come in any sort of real ceasefire and peace or truce. And it's a fascinating conversation. There's certainly a lot at play. One of the key takeouts that Geraldine and I were musing about after that interview was Nadav Eyal's view that what's happening between Israel and the US is not really a permanent fracture in the relationship, but a trouble spot. Now, I would think, Kylie, that what we're seeing is not the image of the US in control of this war. And there has always been from the start that narrative, whether it's true or not, that the US was dragged into this war, that the timing was Israel's alone. Yes, the United States may have had every intention of wanting to go through with this sort of mission one day against Iran. But ultimately, when it came to the strike, that was Israel's decision. And so very, very fascinating dynamics, not just within Israel, but also how Israel's international relationships shape the future.
Yeah, and I think those dynamics are creating a sense of chaos around Donald Trump's management of this war, if you can describe it in that way. You know, if, as it's been suggested, you know, this was the timing of this was decided by Benjamin Netanyahu, that already makes Donald Trump seem as though he's not the one in charge. He's not the commander in chief who's making the final decision. He's being persuaded to do things in a particular way in concert with Israel. I too have doubts about whether or not that's a fair portrayal, but it's certainly that, as you say, that narrative is out there. But it's created this sense that Donald Trump is not fully in charge. He doesn't have a plan. You know, he's now confirming a US Apache helicopter was shot down over Oman or over the Straits of Hormuz. Iran's foreign minister is saying, well, you know, if you come into this field of action, these kinds of things happened. And then, of course, you have Donald Trump apparently trying to ask Benjamin Netanyahu to hold off on his action against Lebanon, which clearly hasn't really resulted in the outcome that he was seeking.
And Kylie, all of this, of course, has meant eyes being taken off the great big ball of Gaza. You know, this was a conflict that was seizing attention every single day for years. And now Gaza has really faded from the headlines, and there's a lot to be paying attention to about what's going on in Gaza. At GlobeSec, the security conference I was in at Prague, I interviewed Nikolai Mladenov, who is Donald Trump's executive or high rep for the Board of Peace for Gaza. Now, he was unusually frank and direct in his criticism of Israel. And he said to me that if this continues, all that is going to happen is another October 7, and that if the parties don't come to the 20-point peace plan that they agreed, then this is just a ticking time bomb. And he's a very sober, cautious figure. For him to be making those very drastic and urgent criticisms on a global stage are, I think, extremely important to pay attention to.
Absolutely. And when you think about some of the things that have happened in Gaza that have gone under the radar, you begin to understand his tone, right? Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered the IDF to seize 70% of the Gaza Strip. So that's beyond the yellow line that already runs the course of the territory. Israel has passed a law to impose the death penalty for people who are convicted of being involved on October 7th. And there are legal changes that will allow for more people to go in front of the courts, with human rights groups saying these new laws sacrifice fairness and due process, which, of course, Israel denies. So our guest today grew up in Gaza. His name is Ahmed Abu Ful. He's a Palestinian lawyer who works within the Al-Haq human rights group. Al-Haq is a very well-established human rights group. It was the first one in Palestine, founded in Ramallah in the West Bank. Now Ahmed lives in The Hague, and he came here to Australia as a party to a case that three Palestinian human rights groups have brought against Australia's Defence Minister, Richard Marles. They have undertaken that case to compel him to release documents relating to the export permits of arms and arms parts and components to Israel. So that, of course, is a reference to Australian sole-sourced parts for the F-35 fighter jet. It's an interesting conversation. Not only do we talk about the case, but also about his own assessment of the state of Gaza, what might happen next, and who really has any influence over that. Here's that conversation now. Ahmed, welcome to Global Roaming.
Well, thank you for having me.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered the IDF to expand its control of Gaza to cover 70% of the territory. So that's well beyond the yellow line that was agreed in the October ceasefire. And we know Palestinians already can't access two-thirds of the territory. So what does this further seizure mean?
First of all, it's important to understand that despite the so-called ceasefire, Israel continued to kill Palestinians every day. And that statement is just another testament to that, that Israel never gave up the ambition of ethnically cleansing Gaza of its population and controlling more land without the people. I know you describe him as the Prime Minister of Israel, and he is. For us, he's a wanted criminal by the International Criminal Court, to which Australia is a party. He's wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity, and the only appropriate place for fugitive wanted criminals is in prison in The Hague, and I hope he lives to see a day. Gaza is for its people, for the Palestinians, and he's not the first, but I hope he will be the last with that colonial ambition, and he will fail like others. What is important to discuss is how to shorten that period of suffering and minimize the suffering. And that requires action from states, including Australia. Had states met their obligations under international law, this genocide could have never been as we witnessed it and would have ended way sooner.
Can I ask, Ahmed, I was based in Gaza in the early 2000s for the BBC. You're from Gaza, grew up there, you were educated there, left 10 years ago. How does the place now compare to what we both once knew it as? I mean, when you see the footage, do you recognize landmarks or signs of the place that it once was?
The Gaza we know no longer exists. It has been destroyed completely. No reasonable international humanitarian law lawyer or military lawyer can tell you that this makes any sense in military or intelligence terms. The purpose was clear: to make Gaza uninhabitable. Israel is not leaving Gaza, and now clearly it's a full-fledged colonialism and ethnic cleansing efforts, and the world continues to watch and look the other way.
So let's get on to why you're here.
Yeah.
There's a case going on in the federal court. Why is a Palestinian lawyer who lives in The Hague involved in bringing a case against Australia's Minister of Defence?
Well, that's the question we also have. Why did we have, as Palestinian organisations? So I work with Al-Haq. We are taking this case together with our partners in the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Centre for Human Rights and the Mizan Centre for Human Rights. And we're doing this through our reliable partner here, the Australian Centre for International Justice. We're taking this case together against the Australian government, asking for transparency. It's an administrative case, judicial review case.
So you're asking for a judicial review?
Yes, ultimately. But at this very stage, we're only asking for transparency for a hearing so the government can share some of the documents where we challenge that decision.
So what are the top three questions you want the defence minister to answer?
Well, we want transparency. We want more information about export licenses to Israel, including F-35.
So whether Australia has broken... I mean, this is my challenge here, is that I understand pushing for a judicial review, but then what's the consequence of it, even if the court were to find...
Yeah.
Against the defence minister, does that mean that Australia would be found to have broken international law?
As a result, yes. The court will not, for example, rule that the government did so, but it will ask the government to review its assessment of those arms licenses. But for us, once we know the documents, we know if Australia has violated its international obligations. What we're trying to do is to see those documents and to show the public. And that's exactly what I wanted to say why three organizations has to come here and challenge the system. And we're doing it for the Australian people. Our argument is that the Australian people deserve to know the truth. You should have access to how your government is making decision. But the government is not being transparent. There's no secret in that.
The government has repeatedly been questioned about this, and they have denied that Australia supplies weapons to Israel, saying that had been the case for at least the past 5 years. This is a comment attributed to a Defence Department spokesperson who has given a statement to the ABC. It says that Australia is not making weapons or ammunition in this country and supplying them to Israel, and that we have an export control regime which requires each application to be assessed on its merits in accordance with Australian export control legislation. So presumably that's their defence.
Well, that is amazing. Then, having said that, you wouldn't have any problem to be transparent with the public. If that's the case, please be transparent with the public.
You've been involved in similar cases in other jurisdictions, as I understand it, in the UK, in the US, in the Netherlands. So how do Australian standards in this matter compare, for example, to the level of transparency in the US?
Well, in the US, it's no secret that you can see all the licenses that have been approved. They're published. You see what goes to Israel. But I tell you about other cases. So in the Netherlands, for example, we supported a case that was taken by our Dutch partners in which the court actually ruled the Dutch government should not supply F-35 parts to Israel or the international program, so indirectly to Israel, because that's the ultimate argument. In the UK, it was a slightly different situation where the government argued national security, and I wanted to contemplate that. Basically, they're saying F-35 parts to Israel ensure UK's national security or contributing to international peace and security. And like any reasonable person, I struggle how the killing of our children is providing a nuclear power with more security. I think what they mean is that they're unwilling to piss off the US. And I think there is some similar consideration here in Australia, which raises a bigger question even. Do we live in liberal democracies that are truly independent and sovereign in their decision-making? Or they're willing, actually, to not meet their legal obligations out of fear of an empire? Because in the UK, it was clear, it's about F-35 and about the UK's responsibility to that international program controlled by the US. This is the ultimate card that they use, international peace and security or national security, so we cannot share the information and you have to trust us that we're making those decisions in accordance with international
law. And you would argue that pushes against the level of transparency that should exist in a democracy.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, there are none in Australia. As I said, you mentioned the statement from the Defense Department, and I want to give it the benefit of the doubt and believe it wholeheartedly. Then we wouldn't have problem to share those documents with the public, right? Why the government is not sharing those documents? Why do we have this hearing? Why do we have this litigation if that's the case? So basically, we're here just to make it clear to the Australian people that this statement is not accurate. And we know for sure that the Australian government is providing Israel with weapons. Early this year, Israel announced receiving new batch of F-35 jets. And at least two parts are manufactured with Australia. So Australia contributes to the crimes committed against the Palestinian people.
When is this case going to be resolved?
Well, you know, litigation can take time. A hearing, the date will be determined. And the parties are talking to each other, as it is in the Australian legal system, to try to find a compromise on what could be shared. We're trying to be very flexible. We're not really asking for much. So our lawyers are trying to provide clear demand of certain documents that need to be shared. And we hope they will be shared because they will show the truth.
Kylie Morris is talking to Ahmed Aboufol, a Palestinian lawyer who works within the Al-Haq human rights group. He grew up and studied in Gaza, but now lives in The Hague. And he's been in Australia to bring a case to the Defence Department about selling weapons parts to Israel.
Can we go back to Gaza?
I wish I can.
You left 10 years ago, didn't you?
Yes.
I'm assuming you still have family there.
Yes. Since the beginning of this genocide, like many Palestinians, I also lost family members. We lost our houses. Lost over 80 members of my family, including my oldest uncle, some cousins, other uncles from other side of the family. And as I said, the Gaza we know no longer exists, and people live in horrendous conditions. Everybody like want to believe that there is a ceasefire and people went back to their normal life. But what does that mean when a whole strip of land, several cities have been decimated, completely destroyed, no services, no infrastructure, and we just in a way seem to have forgotten about them? This is exactly the point that people of Gaza would tell you. It seems like every other year we have Israeli hostility. I can count them for you. I survived three of them, you know, 2008, 2009, 2012, 2014. And then the world will just pay attention for a bit when the bodies of our children are torn apart on their TV screens. And then the moment there is, quote unquote, a ceasefire. Because since the so-called ceasefire, Israel killed hundreds of Palestinians. And then people just want to tell themselves, yeah, it went to normal. But what is normal? Palestinians live under a brutal settler colonial regime, not only in Gaza. In the West Bank, you see settler extremist attacks on Palestinian civilians, the entrenchment of Israel's colonial settlements enterprise, which is, by the way, sustained by the complicity of Western governments like Australia, and continue to support the Israeli army with the tools to maintain that occupation, despite the International Court of Justice ruling that Israel's occupation is unlawful, and that all governments are under the obligation to not render aid or assistance to maintaining that occupation.
So when the head of Donald Trump's Board of Peace spoke at the UN Security Council last week, he warned that the current situation risks becoming permanent. So he urged the UN to use every means at its disposal to do two things, really, to press Hamas to disarm, which is the next stage of this ceasefire, and push Israel to uphold its ceasefire commitments, right? So, in fact, to cease continued killings, as you describe, and to loosen the restrictions on humanitarian aid. Who has the power to influence either Hamas or Israel to do these things?
Yeah, but about the disarmament issue, because it's always put there that they're not meeting their obligations, so Israel's not meeting its obligations. That's not correct. What they're talking about here, because people who listen to us deserve to know the truth, they talk about firearms that are used to maintain public order. What Israel wants is chaos, is the collapse of order within Palestinian civil society.
So can I understand this better? So you're suggesting that Israel's demands to disarm Hamas are in order to create a state of chaos inside Gaza.
Of course, because disarming...
But isn't Hamas creating a state of chaos inside Gaza itself?
You need an order inside. There is a governing body, that is Hamas. You agree with it or don't agree with it. This is preserving somewhat of stability inside the Palestinian civil society. So they're not talking about Hamas capabilities in terms of rockets. Hamas doesn't have that anymore. It's always put as military capabilities, and when someone hears it, think we're talking about aircraft carriers or fighter jets or even rockets or even RPGs. It's none of that. They're talking about small firearms that are carried by police that preserves the order in Gaza. So it's a disingenuous argument. It's never actually about the ceasefire.
If the Palestinians in Gaza were able to say who they want to maintain order inside the Gaza Strip, what would they be likely to tell us?
A Palestinian democratically elected body. And Palestinians have been striving for elections for decades. Israel has been saying no. So any Palestinian anywhere, not only in Gaza, would tell you we want a democratic process, we want an election, and the people choose their representatives.
Does the Palestinian Authority have a role to play in that?
The Palestinian Authority, the president issued a decree instructing the committees to start preparing for elections. Israel said no to allowing elections in East Jerusalem. And it would be an impossibility to have an election without part of Palestine. So the question once again, Palestinian Authority did its part, issued the decree. Every Palestinian agreed. As a matter of fact, the registration reached for elections, for those who can elect, reached 99%. This tells you how much people are craving the opportunity to choose their representatives. The only problem is Israel is preventing that. So that is the question we need to be asking. Why Australia, that prides itself on and brand itself as a democratic country, couldn't utter a word to its ally to say, allow a democratic process?
I understand that you paint Australia as being a tacit supporter of Israel's actions within the Palestinian territories. There has been significant movement in Australia's position in the last 12 months. For example, we have seen the recognition of the State of Palestine by the Australian government. Do you not recognise that there's actually a conversation going on at the highest level of Australian power, as there is in households all around Australia, about what should be a reaction by Australia to this? What is the role that Australia can play?
I'm an international lawyer by training. I measure Australia's compliance with international law by its abidance by the rules, not by what should be perceived as generosity or an advancement of certain positions. The recognition, although long overdue and necessary, is actually meaningless when you continue to provide Israel with weapons to kill Palestinians, when you continue to support Israel and provide it with even diplomatic coverage, when you ensure Israeli impunity, dual nationals. How many Australians have been filmed? Controlled demolitions of Palestinian houses in Gaza. Can you tell me how many cases are there in your prosecution services, in your democracy? I'm sorry, I'm just being blunt here, because I think the time for sugarcoating has long passed. We're talking about the very existence of our people, the very existence of Gaza. We need not to forget, over 80% of Gaza's population are actually refugees, including my own family. We were ethnically cleansed from our homeland in 1948. Pushed to Gaza, forced to live as refugees, are now being ethnically cleansed again. The question is why this has been the case and what has Australia did all of these years? So I'm saying clearly, this is a good step, the recognition, long overdue, but it's merely symbolic in light of the complicity and the continuation of supporting Israel's apartheid.
Ahmed Abu Ful, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So that's Palestinian lawyer Ahmed Abu Ful from the human rights group Al Haq. Latika, what did you make of that?
Well, a very interesting case. I'm not sure it's going to be successful, though. What did you think? Is it a dead end?
Well, I don't know. I mean, talking to Ahmed, my sense is that it's actually the discovery part of this, which there is a real interest in from their perspective. In a way, whether or not you see kind of measures against or relief being sought kind of beyond the initial phase of the case, I think part of the point of this is the human rights groups want to force the Defence Department into a greater transparency over these contracts as part of the discovery process that's achieved, then that will be progress from their perspective. So it was interesting when he talked about, you know, the case in the UK, the case in the US, the case in the Netherlands, and how that proceeded and the different kinds of defence that was being used, right? The UK saying, well, this is a matter of national security, so it's not something that is possible for us to change or to allow greater discussion or investigation into. Whereas in the US, I was interested to know that actually there is a level of transparency around defence export contracts there that we simply don't have here.
Yes, and we do know one thing. The Australian government does not like this topic, full stop. It's something they prefer not to speak about if they can, and when they do or get asked about it in public, they do tend to run a mile and stick to some very bland, banal lines whenever they're asked about some of these details. So I agree with you. I think the process and that process of discovery may actually be the value and benefits rather than the outcome or even striving for an outcome.
Yeah, and I think there is a conversation here that I think a lot of Australians are interested in the sense that while we grapple with these, you know, terribly painful and costly wars in other places, and something we talk about really often on Global Roaming, right? Where is our kind of personal responsibility for that? And even as a nation, Australia is comparatively small fry, right? So what role do we have to play in any of this? Where are our kind of ethical and political responsibilities when the world is on fire? I think it's an interesting case because it does link, I guess, what Australians on an individual level know about our government's participation in these supply chains, which ultimately do help to put planes in the air, which are used for bombing raids.
Yes, Kylie, as Ahmed told you, this case is not going away. It's going to run for some time. So I think it's something we'll be revisiting and certainly hearing a lot more about. Time for some feedback, Kylie. We've had some very nice mail in the inbox about our conversation with Jade McGlynn about Ukraine, and she was just fantastic, Jade. Mark writes in and he says, I listened with a lot of interest to this episode and came away feeling that Ukraine has modernised and reshaped guerrilla warfare. They have adapted an old way of military campaign by bringing in contemporary technology, and it appears to be working. While I feel there's a long way to go, like was discussed, it would seem the Russian bear is slowly succumbing to the Ukrainian mosquitoes. If you look at most species, this is how they all fall, to the smaller, more populous species, unless they've been knocked out by one singular initial strike. Great episode and podcast. Thank you. Well, Mark, that's a very thoughtful comment. So thank you very much for listening and for writing in. And all of your thoughts are always welcome. We like your ideas. And as you know, we often take them on board and do whole programs about them. So you can email us at global.roaming@abc.net.au.
And I'll see you again, Latika.
See you soon, Kylie.
Thanks to our producer too, Kylie Gray. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.